A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
So Daniel sent us this one, and the timing couldn't be sharper. Yesterday, Andrew Tate and his brother Tristan were arrested in Miami on human trafficking charges. That's a dramatic capstone to a decade-long pipeline that runs from obscure pickup forums to felony indictments. Daniel's question is essentially, how did we get here? He sees the manosphere and the looks-maxing phenomenon as a radical overcorrection. A pull so far in one direction that it's responding to a discourse on gender and sexuality that had already been skewed from normal identity. He's clear he doesn't endorse the misogyny, and neither do we, but the structural question stands. What conditions made this movement attractive to millions of young men?
And the arrest crystallizes something we've been circling for a while. It forces us to ask not just who is Andrew Tate, but what was the infrastructure that produced him? Because Tate didn't build this from scratch. He's a late-stage aggregator who synthesized threads that had been weaving for 20 years.
And I think that's the part that gets lost in the news cycle. The arrest becomes a story about one guy. But one guy doesn't radicalize millions of young men unless there's a machine underneath him. What was the machine?
That's the question. So let's back up. What exactly is the manosphere, and how did we get here?
Walk us through it.
The first thing to get straight is that the manosphere isn't a monolith. It's more like a loose confederation of sub-movements that share a common grievance but have different goals, different internal tensions, and different origin stories. You've got pickup artists, men going their own way, the red pill, men's rights activists, and looks-maxing. They converge on a shared belief that men are systematically disadvantaged in modern society, but they disagree on what to do about it.
And the taxonomy matters, because if you treat it as one unified movement, you miss how someone moves through it. A 16-year-old searching how to be more confident around girls isn't looking for an ideology. He's looking for a technique. The ideology finds him later.
And that pipeline, from technique to ideology to identity, is the whole story, so let's trace the genealogy. The earliest roots are the pickup artist community, which really crystallized online in the early 2000s. You had forums like MysteryMethod.com, which was built around a guy who called himself Mystery, and later Rougefy's blog, which became a central hub. The framing was almost technical. Game was presented as a set of behavioral techniques you could learn, practice, and optimize. It wasn't ideological yet, or at least, it didn't present itself that way. It was more like, here's a skill set, here's how you improve your success rate.
Which is a fascinating frame when you think about it. The foundational move of the pickup artist era was to take something most people experience as deeply personal and emotional, attraction, rejection, romantic connection, and reframe it as an engineering problem. There are inputs, there are outputs, there are optimal strategies. You can debug your social life.
And that frame never went away. It's the intellectual architecture that everything else gets built on. The pivot came with the Red Pill subreddit, which launched around 2012 and really took off in the following years before it was banned in 2020 for violating Reddit's harassment policy. The Red Pill took the pickup artist's technical frame and added a biological determinism layer. The argument was that female mate selection isn't just a social phenomenon, it's an evolutionary algorithm. Women are hardwired to select for status, resources, and physical dominance. Any man who doesn't understand this is living in a delusion.
So the engineering problem gets upgraded. It's not just learn these conversational techniques, it's understand the underlying biological operating system and hack it.
Right. And that's where the grievance politics enter. Because if mate selection is a deterministic biological hierarchy, then any social arrangement that doesn't explicitly acknowledge that hierarchy is a lie designed to keep men compliant. Feminism becomes not a movement for equality, but a system of deception. The Red Pill's central metaphor, taken from The Matrix, is that most men are living in a comfortable illusion, and taking the Red Pill means seeing the brutal truth about gender relations.
Which is a powerful narrative structure. You're not just learning dating advice, you're being initiated into hidden knowledge. There's an us versus them, a sense of being among the few who really get it.
And that's the emotional hook. It's worth pausing on why that hook works so well. If you're a young man who's struggling socially, the mainstream world tells you some version of be yourself, be respectful, it'll work out. But when it doesn't work out, and for a lot of awkward teenagers, it doesn't. You're left with a choice. Either there's something wrong with you, or the advice you were given was a lie. The red pill offers door number two. It says, you're not broken. You were just lied to. The system is rigged. Here's how it actually works.
That's a much easier pill to swallow than I need to work on myself in a deep, non-transactional way.
Much easier. Meanwhile, around 2015, you get the emergence of MGTOW, men going their own way. This is a fascinating offshoot because it's essentially a withdrawal strategy. The argument is that the legal and social system is so stacked against men, in divorce courts, in custody battles, in workplace harassment claims, that the only rational response is to opt out entirely. No marriage, no cohabitation, minimal romantic entanglement.
There's a deep irony here that I don't think gets enough attention. MG Tao's whole premise is, we're leaving the dating market. But when a significant number of men withdraw, what happens to the men who stay in? The competition intensifies. You've now got a smaller pool of men competing for the same pool of women, which means the stakes are higher, the pressure is higher, and the demand for any technique that gives you an edge goes up.
Which is exactly where looks maxing enters the picture. And this is the part of the story that I think is genuinely undercovered. Looks maxing originated on 4chan's fitness board around 2014 to 2015. It started innocuously enough, lifting weights, skincare routines, better fashion choices. The basic idea was, maximize your physical attractiveness through effort. Nothing inherently problematic there.
The word itself is telling. Looks maxing. It's optimization language. You're not getting in shape or taking care of yourself. You're maxing out a stat.
And that language comes straight from video game culture. You've got a character sheet, you've got attributes, and you want to raise your numbers. The subreddit TrueRateMe is a perfect case study here. It's a community where people post photos of themselves and other users assign numerical ratings to their faces. Not, you look nice, or that haircut works for you. A number, usually on a scale where 5 is average and anything above 7 is exceptional. And then, the community prescribes interventions. Specific surgical procedures to raise your score.
Let me give a concrete example of how this plays out, because I think the mechanics matter. A young man posts his photo. He gets rated a 4.5. The community tells him his contour tilt is negative. That's the angle of the outer corner of the eye relative to the inner corner. His interpupillary distance is suboptimal. His jaw is too narrow. Now, before he posted that photo, he probably just thought of his face as his face. Maybe he didn't love it, but he didn't have a vocabulary for its specific deficiencies. Now he has a diagnostic manual. He knows exactly which features are dragging down his score. And conveniently, there are procedures for each one.
So the engineering frame reaches its logical endpoint. Your face is not your face. It's a collection of suboptimal features that can be individually optimized through the right procedures.
And notice what's happened to his self-perception. He walked in with a vague sense of dissatisfaction. He walked out with a quantified defect list. That's not nothing. That changes how you move through the world.
And this is where it hardens. By the late 2010s, looks maxing had moved well beyond skincare and lifting. You get mewing, a tongue posture technique promoted by a British orthodontist named John Mew, which claims that pressing your tongue against the roof of your mouth can reshape your jawline over time. The subreddit for this, Orthotropics, grew from about 10,000 subscribers in 2018 to over 200,000 by 2022. There is essentially zero scientific evidence that mewing does anything meaningful for adults. The bone structure of your face is not responsive to tongue pressure once you're past puberty.
But the appeal isn't scientific. It's the appeal of a secret technique that the mainstream doesn't want you to know about. Again, hidden knowledge. And the hidden knowledge frame does something clever. It immunizes itself against counter-evidence. If a study comes out saying mewing doesn't work, that's just proof that the establishment is suppressing the truth. The absence of evidence becomes evidence of the conspiracy.
Right. and from mewing, it escalates to hard looks maxing, actual surgical intervention. Jaw implants, cheek fillers, brow ridge augmentation, limb lengthening surgery, where they literally break your leg bones and insert rods to add inches to your height. These are serious medical procedures with real risks, and they're being discussed in online forums as optimization strategies.
I want to pause on limb lengthening for a second, because it's such a stark illustration. This is a procedure where they break both your femurs, insert telescoping rods, and you spend months in excruciating rehabilitation. It costs tens of thousands of dollars. It can add maybe 2 or 3 inches to your height. And it's being discussed in the same register as, have you tried a new moisturizer? The normalization of that level of bodily intervention among teenagers and young men is new.
The thing that connects all of this, pickup artistry, red pill, MG Tauyu, looks maxing, is the core epistemic commitment. Social outcomes are governed by objective, often biological, laws that can be hacked. Whether it's conversational techniques or cheekbone implants, the frame is the same. Your unhappiness is not a complex emotional experience rooted in your personal history, your cultural context, your specific relationships. It's a technical problem with a technical solution.
And that's seductive. It's seductive because it offers certainty. If your loneliness is a technical problem, then you don't have to sit with the much harder questions about who you are, what you want, how you relate to other people, what you're afraid of. You just need to optimize the right variables.
There's an analogy here that I think is useful. Imagine you're trying to learn to play music. The mainstream advice is something like practice. Develop your ear, find your voice, connect with the emotion of the piece. That's hard, it's slow. It requires vulnerability. Now imagine someone comes along and says, no, music is just physics. Here are the exact frequencies that produce pleasure in the human auditory system. Here's the algorithm for chord progressions that trigger dopamine release. Just follow the formula. That's the Manosphere's pitch. It reduces the terrifying, beautiful complexity of human connection to an instruction manual.
And the tragedy is that the instruction manual sometimes produces results. A guy reads pickup material. He learns to project confidence. He starts getting dates. The technique works well enough to confirm the ideology. He doesn't realize that what actually worked was becoming less anxious and more socially practiced, which you can achieve without the misogyny. He attributes his success to the red pill framework.
Which brings us to Andrew Tate. Because Tate's genius, and I use that word descriptively, not admiringly, was to synthesize all of these threads, his early content was essentially pickup artist material. How to pick up women, how to be alpha. But he pivoted. By the time he became a global phenomenon, his content wasn't really about techniques for interacting with women. It was about how to become a high-value man. The frame shifted from behavioral hacks to ontological transformation.
And that's the move that the broader Manosphere made. It stopped being here's how to get dates and became here's who you need to be. The product isn't dating advice. The product is identity.
And identity is a much stickier product. You can abandon a technique that stops working. You can't abandon who you are.
So that's the mechanism. A shared belief in hackable social laws, an escalating ladder of interventions, and a pivot from technique to identity. But what happens when that belief system meets platform algorithms?
This is where it gets dangerous. The Manosphere's growth wasn't inevitable. It was shaped by specific platform design choices. YouTube's recommendation algorithm, Reddit's upvote system, TikTok's For You page, all of these are optimized for engagement. And what drives engagement? Stronger claims, more extreme positions, more outrage.
There was a Mozilla study in 2019 that tracked this. They found that if you started watching what you might call moderate Manosphere content, how to be more confident, dating advice for men, the recommendation algorithm would serve you increasingly extreme content. Within 3 to 5 videos, you'd be getting why women are shallow, then the red pill truth, then outright misogyny.
3 to 5 videos. That's maybe 20 minutes of watching. And the architecture is doing this not because anyone programmed it to radicalize young men, but because extreme content generates more watch time, more comments, more shares. The algorithm is just optimizing for the metric it was given. The radicalization is a side effect.
And we should be precise about what extreme means in this context. It's not just that the claims get stronger, it's that the emotional valence shifts. The moderate content is aspirational. Here's how to improve. The extreme content is resentful. Here's who's holding you back. Resentment is stickier than aspiration. It generates more comments because people argue in the comments. It generates more shares because outrage travels faster than encouragement. The algorithm learns this and doubles down.
So the pipeline is real, and it's been documented. The Southern Poverty Law Center put out a report in 2021 tracing the pathway from Manosphere content to alt-right radicalization. And what's striking is that the pipeline doesn't require anyone to be a bad actor in the traditional sense. You don't need a recruiter. You just need a teenager with normal insecurities and a YouTube account.
And that's the overreaction thesis that Daniel's getting at. Let's sit with that for a minute. The 2010s were a period of intense public conversation about gender. You had Me Too. You had the term toxic masculinity entering mainstream usage. You had campus Title IX reforms. You had a widespread cultural reckoning with sexual harassment and assault. All of that was necessary and overdue. But it also created something, a perceived vacuum of legitimacy around male experience.
Perceived is the key word. I'm not saying the vacuum was real in the sense that men were actually being silenced, but the perception was powerful. If the dominant public discourse about masculinity is primarily about its toxic forms, and if the conversation about male sexuality is primarily about harm and consent violations, then a lot of young men feel like there's no language for their own experiences that doesn't cast them as potential perpetrators.
And let me push on this a bit, because I think the perceived qualifier does important work. When we say the vacuum was perceived, we're not saying young men were wrong to feel alienated. We're saying the alienation came from a particular interpretation of the discourse, not necessarily from the discourse itself. But here's the thing. From a psychological standpoint, it barely matters whether the vacuum was real or perceived. If you feel like there's no space for your experience, you're going to go looking for a space that welcomes it. And the manosphere is standing there with open arms.
And nature abhors a vacuum. The manosphere filled it with a counter-narrative that wasn't just critical of mainstream gender discourse, it inverted it entirely. In the manosphere's frame, men are the oppressed class. Women are the privileged gatekeepers. Any accusation of harm is a weapon deployed against men. The entire structure of Me Too is a witch hunt.
Which is a radical overcorrection. If the mainstream discourse says men need to examine their behavior, the manosphere says men are the victims of a gynocentric conspiracy. It's not a moderate response, it's a mirror image. And mirror images are rhetorically powerful because they use the same structure as the thing they're opposing. They just flip the polarity.
And here's the practical implication. If you work in tech policy, content moderation, or youth mental health, you need to understand something crucial. The manosphere's appeal is not primarily ideological, it's emotional. These communities offer three things to young men who feel adrift: certainty, agency, and belonging. Certainty. Here are the rules of how the world actually works. Agency. Here are concrete steps you can take to improve your situation. Belonging. You are part of a community of men who see the truth.
Let's unpack those three, because they're doing different kinds of work. Certainty is the epistemic offer. The world is legible. There are rules. You can learn them. Agency is the practical offer. You're not powerless. There are things you can do right now. Belonging is the social offer. You're not alone. There are others like you. And notice that none of these inherently require misogyny. The misogyny is the payload, but the vehicle is a set of legitimate human needs.
And if your moderation strategy only targets hate speech without addressing those underlying needs, you will fail. You'll ban a subreddit and the users will migrate to a different platform. You'll deplatform a creator and his audience will follow him to wherever he goes next. Rushvi shut down his pickup site in 2019 after years of controversy, and what happened? His audience didn't disappear. They scattered to more extreme corners of the internet.
The case study we covered in a previous episode is instructive here. The clavicular incident in Tel Aviv, a streamer whose manosphere-adjacent persona led to a real-world confrontation at a nightclub. The line between online performance and offline consequence is basically gone. These aren't just people posting. They're living out these identities in public spaces, and sometimes that crosses into harm.
And what's frightening about the clavicular case is how legible it was in retrospect. You could see the escalation happening in real time. The persona got more extreme, the audience rewarded it, the real-world behavior followed. It's not that the internet caused the behavior, it's that the internet provided a feedback loop that amplified and validated it.
So the pipeline is real, it's dangerous, and it's resilient. What do we actually do about it?
The most actionable insight, and I think this is something parents and educators especially need to hear, is that the most effective intervention is not to debunk the claims. If you sit a young man down and explain why the red pill's evolutionary psychology is pseudoscientific, or why mewing doesn't work, or why Andrew Tate is a grifter, you're likely to trigger a backfire effect. The claims aren't why he's there. He's there because he feels seen and understood by that community. Attacking the claims feels like attacking him.
So what works?
Offering alternative communities that provide the same three things: certainty, agency, and belonging. Sports teams, mentoring programs, hobby groups, volunteer organizations. Places where young men can feel competent and connected without the ideological payload. It sounds almost too simple, but the research on deradicalization consistently points in this direction. You don't argue someone out of an identity. You give them somewhere else to belong.
And I want to add a nuance here, because sports teams and hobby groups can sound dismissively simple. The key is that these communities need to offer genuine competence, not participation trophies. Not everyone's a winner. Young men who are drawn to the manosphere are often looking for a path to mastery. They want to get good at something. The manosphere gives them a ladder to climb. First you learn game, then you internalize the red pill, then you become a high-value man. If your alternative community just says, you're fine the way you are, it's not going to compete. It needs to say, here's a hard thing you can become excellent at, and we'll help you do it.
That's a crucial point. The manosphere's ladder is toxic, but it is a ladder. A lot of mainstream spaces have lost the ability to offer ladders to young men because we've become uncomfortable with hierarchy and competition altogether. But the desire for mastery doesn't go away just because we've decided it's problematic. It just goes looking for an outlet that will honor it.
For the tech professionals listening, there's a design lesson here too. The manosphere's growth was shaped by recommendation algorithms that optimize for engagement. Engagement-driven algorithms will always favor escalation, because extreme content is more engaging than moderate content. If you're building a platform, you need to decide whether time on site is really the metric you want to maximize, because that metric has downstream consequences.
And this isn't hypothetical. We now have a decade of data showing that engagement optimization produces radicalization as a byproduct. The question is whether platforms are willing to accept lower engagement numbers in exchange for less harmful outcomes. So far, the market has not rewarded that choice.
And for everyone else, the overreaction thesis suggests something uncomfortable. The manosphere is not going to disappear just because its most visible leaders get arrested. Tate's arrest may even strengthen his mythos. The Mata narrative is already being constructed in real time across Telegram and Twitter. The only durable countermeasure is to rebuild a mainstream discourse around gender that leaves room for male vulnerability without descending into misogyny.
That's the hard part. It's easy to condemn the manosphere. It's much harder to build a positive vision of masculinity that's compelling enough to compete with it. The manosphere offers a story about what it means to be a man. A toxic story, but a clear one. If the mainstream can't offer a better story, the pipeline will keep flowing.
And I think this is where a lot of well-intentioned efforts fall short. They try to offer a story that's basically, masculinity can be anything you want it to be. That's not a story. That's the absence of a story. Young men who are searching for an identity aren't looking for infinite optionality. They're looking for a defined path with recognizable milestones. The manosphere gives them that. If the alternative is just be a good person, that's not going to cut it.
Which brings us to the open question that will define the next few years. Will Tate's arrest accelerate the manosphere's decline or cement his martyrdom? History suggests the latter. When you arrest a figure like this, you don't erase his ideas. You give his followers a persecution narrative. Roosh V's site shutdown in 2019 didn't end the pickup artist community, it fragmented and radicalized it. The same thing is likely happening right now.
The manosphere is a symptom, not the disease. The disease is a culture that leaves young men with no vocabulary for their own pain, except the language of grievance. Until we build better vocabularies, until there are mainstream spaces where young men can say, I'm lonely, I feel invisible, I don't know how to be a man in a world that seems to hate men, without being told they're part of the problem, the pipeline will keep flowing. The arrests won't stop it. The deplatforming won't stop it. Only a better story will.
And that better story has to be more than just, not that. It has to offer its own version of certainty, agency, and belonging. It has to give young men a ladder worth climbing. That's a creative challenge, not just a political one. It's about art, culture, mentorship, community. It's about building things, not just condemning things.
And on that note, a brief fun fact from Hilbert.
In the early 1500s, the term naked mole rat entered European languages as a calque of the Arabic Jarad al-Kuldi, which translates literally as rat of the eternal, a name that may reflect the animal's subterranean habits, since underground creatures were often associated with the underworld and thus with immortality in medieval bestiaries.
A rat of the eternal. I'm not sure what to do with that, but I feel like there's a metaphor in there somewhere about things that survive by staying underground.
Thanks, Hilbert. That's one for the fridge.
This has been my weird prompts. If you want to dig deeper into the gender discourse that the manosphere is reacting against, check out our episode on what feminists actually mean by the patriarchy. It provides the other side of the dialectic. You can find it and everything else we've done at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.